a National Newspaper Award for editorial cartooning 7 times, making him the most honored journalist in any category in the 50-year history of the awards. His cartoons have won many citations and international awards, including the Montreal International Grand Prix and the Quill Award for Communication Excellence. In the year 2000, he received the Jack Webster Bruce Hutcheson Lifetime Achievement Award. He has served as president of associations of Canadian and of American editorial cartoonists. He received the Ink Bottle Award from the AAEC for his outstanding contribution to the profession. His work has appeared in all major Canadian and most American newspapers and magazines, as well as The Spectator and Punch in Britain. In addition to newspaper cartoons, Roy Peterson has illustrated books, including Frog Fables and Beaver Tales with Stanley Burke, Last Page First with Alan Fotheringham, and his own books, including The World According to Roy Peterson, Drawn and Quartered, and the Canadian ABC Book. Roy was married to the late Margaret Brand Peterson for 44 blissful years, and 4 of their 5 children are in the audience tonight, and we welcome them and are glad to have them with us. One last personal note, if you'll permit me. Roy and I were in the same graduating class at Kitsilano High School nearly half a century ago. He was already then the class cartoonist and illustrator for all school events. We had the best posters of any school in the country. And to top this off, our thank you for this evening, following the question period, will be given by Jack Lee, another member of that same illustrious class. Jack is known to you, I'm sure, as an award-winning radio broadcaster with both CJOR and CKWX, the marketing manager of the PNE before that, and a journalist with the Vancouver Sun after he graduated from Kitsilano High School. He has more recently done public relations work for UBC and the United Way, among other groups. Please forgive this rather lengthy introduction to my 2 co-graduates, but perhaps you will forgive me for my pride in their achievements. And now I'd like to ask Roy Peterson to come forward and entertain us.
Thank you, Kyle. Very nice of you. Well, I think tonight we'll see if cartoonists like children should be seen and not heard. My name is Roy Peterson, and I'm a close approximation of the face up here. I've been a freelance cartoonist for the past 41 years, working primarily for the Vancouver Sun as an editorial cartoonist. Canada has approximately 25 to 30 full-time editorial cartoonists. With a population of 30 million, that makes the job a 1 in a million job. And I'm keeping mine. But when I say editorial cartoonist, what does that mean? There are many types of cartoonists. There's gag cartoonists, comic strip cartoonists, advertising cartoonists, animation cartoonists, and, of course, the editorial cartoonist. The editorial cartoonist's job is to make a comment or point about events of the day, whether political, social, or economic in nature. He or she should not always simply make a joke. Indeed, if all you want is a joke, go to the comic page. This is what I say all the time, because really editorial cartoons can be serious. They can be symbolic. They can be any number of things. And each day is really different, or should be, for the cartoonist. The editorial cartoonist's purpose is to stimulate the reader's mind, and whether he or she agrees with the cartoon, at least it causes one to reflect on the events of the day. The editorial cartoon is the first thing you see on the editorial page because it's visual. You can read and mentally digest it in less than 10 seconds. Actually, it's about 7 seconds. However, if the cartoonist has done a good job, the idea will stick in your mind for days, weeks, or months later, sometimes years. However, when I say you can read a cartoon in less than 10 seconds, it can take me at least a full day to produce it. To combine a crystallized thought with a definitive line has taken me over 40 years, and I'm still trying to do it right. And although editorial cartoonists use computers and modern technology, we are still laboring in our cloistered bench, more like monks in the Middle Ages than the Silicon Valley whiz kids that you see on computers. So let's define the word cartoon.
Yes.
So let's define the word cartoon. The dictionary defines cartoon as a preparatory design or drawing for a finished painting. Or the second definition is a drawing that is often symbolic and usually intended as humor, caricature, or satire and comment on public and political matters. The term caricature stems from the Italian word caricatura, meaning overloaded, an art style developed late in the 16th century by the Bolognese painter Annibale Carracci, who founded a school of portraiture in which character was explored by the exaggeration of figure and face. However, it was in Flanders and the 17th century Holland and in London of William Hogarth, shown here, that the editorial and political cartoon began to flower. Hogarth was concerned more with social affairs than politics. Even his series, The Election, which is shown here, one of the panels, it was a series of four, was only a highly generalized comment on politics. It was really about human nature, and he was a master of that. However, the influence of his realistic style and sense of the dramatic on his contemporaries elevated caricature into an art form that by the end of the 18th century was the most admired in Europe. This slide shows his engraving and woodcut versions of Hogarth's Cruelty of Perfection based on an account of a sensational murder. Now, Hogarth employed an engraver to make woodcut versions of his plates to reach the popular market directly in a vain attempt to forestall copyists. In those days, there were other cartoonists who would simply steal his ideas and draw them up themselves and sell them off. So he hired his own man to make woodcuts and sell them directly to the populace. Now then, here we have the robust artistry of Hogarth and fellow cartoonists Henry Bunbury, Thomas Rowlandson, and Isaac Cruikshank led to the work of James Gilray, shown here. For sheer impact, Gilray excelled. He was the first master draftsman to devote himself to the regular production of political satires. I selected this slide because it shows in the background, if If you can see, it's a window with a door, and in the window are caricatures. This was, in fact, Mistress Humphrey's print shop. Mistress Humphrey was Gilray's publisher at the time. Now then, this slide is rather interesting, I thought, and it's apropos of something that Canadians would be interested in. It shows The Death of the Great Wolf by Gilray, a parody of Benjamin West's painting Death of Wolf. The figure of General Wolf has been changed to Prime Minister William Pitt, who was the Prime Minister at the time. And I've included this one to remind us all that when General Wolf died on the Plains of Abraham, the French had to surrender to a cartoonist and a caricaturist. Many people don't realize that. He was, in fact, George Townsend, the fourth Viscount Townsend, who was an amateur caricaturist and cartoonist. Although he was a feeble draftsman himself, Townsend's fertility of malicious invention and his power to capture likenesses paved the way for Gilray in establishing personal caricature as an essential ingredient of political prints. Now, Gilray's work was known as caricature at the time. As previously defined, the word cartoon meant no more than a preliminary sketch for a painting. But when, in July 1843, the British government held an exhibition of cartoons that had been commissioned to beautify the Houses of Parliament, the humor magazine Punch, feeling there were better uses for the money, published this picture of a ragged crowd inspecting a gallery of elegant paintings. The picture by John Leech was titled Cartoon Number One and earned his drawing the name Cartoon. The word stuck and took on the satirical meaning it has today. So that was the first official cartoon. Now then, these are Punch covers. In January 1849, Richard Doyle designed this cover for Punch magazine. It was used consistently until 1956. They weren't really into magazine covers in those days. Although you'll notice on some of these covers, the advertising changes from week to week. The weekly publication of Punch meant that satirical comment was no longer limited to the sale of prints. But Punch staff artists became the most distinguished caricatures of the mid-19th century. In the United States, Thomas Nast's campaign against Boss Tweed and his corrupt Tammany Hall cronies made him one of the most powerful cartoonists at a time when editorial cartooning had risen to ever greater heights. As Boss Tweed said, "I don't care what the papers write about me. My constituents can't read, but damn it, they can see pictures." A Tammany bagman was sent to Nast's home with an offer of $100,000, and in those days, $100,000 was big money, if Nast would study art in Europe. "Do you think I could get $200,000? Asked the $5,000-a-year artist. "Well, possibly. You have a great talent." Eventually, the cartoonist bid up the bagman to $500,000. Then Nast said, "I don't think I'll go to Europe. I made up my mind not long ago to put these fellows behind bars, and I'm going to put them there." And he did. Now then, the father of Canadian editorial cartooning was John Bengo, born in Toronto in 1851. This is an example of his work. That's Sir John A. there. At the start of his career, no Ontario newspaper used political cartoons. However, within a year of his cartoon's appearance, Sir John A. was defeated, and Bengo's cartoons were partly responsible. Although, in fact, Sir John A. enjoyed the cartoons, and he thought of Van Gogh as his favorite cartoonist. He published his cartoons in his own newspaper called Grip from 1873 to 1892, and he later worked on the Toronto Globe and the Montreal Star. And this one I've included for local interest. It shows British Columbia threatening to leave Canada because the railroad had still not been put through. And so we jump 100 years at least, and we see the work of Duncan McPherson, who is Canada's best political editorial cartoonist, as far as I'm concerned. He worked for the Toronto Star. Here again, we're showing Sir John A. Some 100 years later. And things really haven't changed that much. Now, this is the legendary comment on John Diefenbaker. This is an icon among cartoons now in Canada. And this was drawn by Duncan McPherson when John Diefenbaker canceled the Avro Arrow, and it was titled Let Them Eat Cake. And that's a beauty. That is a classic. It's in the National Archives, as a matter of fact. And this one depicts the endless, dragged-out political war between Diefenbaker and Lester Pearson, which continued on and on and on, much like Chrétien nowadays, in fact. But now then, Canada's best social comment editorial cartoonist, of course, was the Vancouver Sun's Len Norris. This is a 1959 cartoon. I don't know if you can read the title there. It says, "Okay, dear, drive me to drink." And it shows that even back then they knew more than the Premier Campbell does nowadays. Now this one is another Len Norris cartoon from 1975. And the cut line says, "The problem with giving lands back to the Indian and Eskimo peoples leaves the CPR owning all the rest." And it really shows Len's versatility there. Now then, this one is really very much in Len's style, and it shows his handling of street scenes. He also loved cars, old cars, new cars, whatever. He really enjoyed them. And it shows the way Len has distilled the English style of cartooning of such great cartoonists as Searle, Roland Emmett, and Giles, and combined them to make his own style. And Len was a great fan of Giles. Never met him, but here we have a picture from 1970 of Len and myself in London at a cartoonist conference. And actually, in the background, you can see a number of bobbies. An hour later, there were bodies there. This was an anti-war event against the Vietnam War, and the crowd was marching on the U.S. Embassy in London. Len was the type that was not really involved in that sort of thing, so he asked if we could retire to a pub which had a window and we could look out and see what was going on. And it was his style. That's the way he enjoyed public demonstrations. But at this conference, which was given by the London Cartoonist Group as well as the Royal British Society of Cartoonists, Carl Giles was the president at the time. And We were lined up one night to go into a large hall to meet the various British cartoonists. As we came through the door, there was a major domo in red velvet waistcoat, etc., gold braid, the pants, the stockings, the buckled shoes, who would announce your name as you came through the door. Now, as we were inching our way towards the door, Len realized that he didn't have his name tag. The majordomo would look at your name tag and then say your name as you went through in a very booming voice. So we were in line with Pat Oliphant, the great Australian cartoonist who went to the United States and changed cartooning there, and Ben Wicks. And Pat Oliphant pulled out a cigarette package, tore it up, and on the back of the package wrote a name and stuck it in Len's pocket. So as we went through the door, the major domo looked at his card and he said, "Derek Fogleworthy." And Len went down and met Carl Giles for the first time in his life, and Carl Giles never knew who it was. And he never met him again, unfortunately. That's a true story. Now then, it looks like we're getting closer to some of my examples. I use this photo to introduce my own work. This shows Ben Wicks looking bored, but Pierre Trudeau seems to be rather interested. And that was in Ottawa many years ago. Now then, this is a takeoff of a Malden cartoon. Bill Malden, the great World War II cartoonist, as you know, just died a couple of weeks ago. And this is my takeoff on a Bill Malden cartoon. It shows the World War II cavalry sergeant dispatching his mount after it broke its axle. My version appeared when Mercedes-Benz Daimler took over Jeep Chrysler some many years later. And there were a number of problems there. Anyways, I won't go on. Now then, this one is entitled, "You Volunteered?" It shows when Nixon took over the Vietnam War from LBJ. And this cartoon won the Overseas Press Club First Place Award in the United States until they found out that the cartoon hadn't appeared in a U.S. newspaper. So they took the prize away, and it went to the second place American cartoonist. However, the judge was Milton Caniff of Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon fame, and the fact that he chose it as number one was good enough for me. And I still think that. Now, this is a cartoon of Nixon as Richard III, and it just sort of demonstrates something that I like to do from time to time, is take quotes from Shakespeare and try and apply them to present-day situations. And this one rather worked rather well, I thought. I think you can read it. Oh, you can't read it? "March on, march on, since we are up in arms, if not to fight the foreign enemies, yet to beat down these rebels here at home." And he's hiding the tapes. Now, this was towards the end of his career as president. And it was my attempt at a Deli-esque cartoon. I was actually experimenting using non-transparent gouache paint on this cartoon, and it really took too long. I never used that medium again. But it was fun to fool around with it at the time. Now then. This is a 1980 cartoon. Ronald Reagan arrives on the scene with a Goldwater mindset. And
it pretty well explains itself, I think.
And then 1981, and the title of this cartoon was Liberty, and it shows how the U.S. gun culture had finally reached the head of state. And it tried to make a point about guns, which nobody's ever going to take to heart, I think, in the United States. Now, this one is Klaus Barbie and co-defendant. Klaus Barbie, of course, was a Nazi war criminal. And when he was captured and brought back for trial in 1983, it turned out that his co-defendant in the cartoon had assisted in his escape to South America after World War II. The OSS evidently helped him to escape after he gave them much information. Now, this is Teflon Ron. This is Ronald Reagan. He was known as the Teflon president. This was done in 1985. Sometimes the Teflon worked, but sometimes the stitching gave way. So that was that one. Now, Maggie Thatcher, of course, was known as the nanny of Great Britain until the wheels fell off. So that was pretty well self-explanatory again. Now, this is a Persian market scene. This is in 1990, Iraq, before the Gulf War. And the Persian market, of course, was where you could buy almost everything or anything except nuclear triggers. And then, of course, we had the start of the Gulf War. Gas up the barbecue. This is January 1991. And it, when you think that here we are, what, some 12, 13 years later, and we're still at the same point, it shows you that history does tend to repeat itself. Now then, here we have George Bush Sr. When he launched the ground war in Kuwait and Iraq. Mars, the god of war, of course, is ordering one ground round to go. And Mr. Bush is saying one new world order, hot and greasy. You want to give peas a chance, too? And then, of course, in February of 1991, Gorbachev attempted to broker a peace agreement with Saddam, and Saddam, in his own peaceful way, replied. So by October 1991, George Bush Sr. felt confident enough to disarm all of his short-range weapons. And there he is throwing away his Derringer, although everything else is in place. Now we skip back to 1989 on this one. This shows the collapse of communism. It's one of my favorite cartoons, actually, because I was able to get in a lot of old, tired-out dictators. And where better to meet your comrades but in bankruptcy court? And I really enjoyed doing that one because some of them I really never had a chance to do and really haven't had a chance to do them since. Now, of course, the flip side to the collapse of communism is the collapse of the Billy Bob Bubbas in the United States. The Billy Bob Bubbas, of course, are the guys who, mainly in the southern United States, but all over the states, you see them driving in their trucks with the gun in the back of the cab, and the truck is plastered with all these bumper stickers that say better red than dead and all that sort of thing. And, of course, the wife is saying, but Billy Bob Bubba, surely you had some sort of plan for after you finally defeated communism. So what else do I do? Here's a selection of magazine covers that I've done over the years for Maclean's Magazine and Time Magazine, and showing you the various times and events that have gone on. The cover in the center is a cover that you didn't see. This was to be the first cover for Maclean's Magazine when it became a news magazine. Up until then, it had been a general issue magazine with general features, but they changed it to a news magazine, and they asked me if I would do the cover of Trudeau, and I said yes, and so I did this one. They accepted it and had it all set to go. It was on the presses, and the publisher came through and saw it, and it just had a conniption fit and said, this is not going to be produced. And he had them take it off the press, and instead there was a very bad photographic cover appeared. But as a result, two or three of the editors quit, and there was a major foofraw for a week or two after. And, you know, I didn't mean to cause all that trouble, but but somehow it happened. This is a bit more of a close-up of it. And this is an illustration for Maclean's Magazine when Jimmy Carter made his official visit to Canada. This was in the days when the President of the United States would make his first official visit. He would come to Canada. They don't do that anymore. Now, this is the 60s poster. This was done in November, I think, of 1969. And I did this on spec when I figured that the Vancouver Sun might use it. I don't know if we can get in any closer on it. But I started in around the 1st of November, and I would do a little bit each night after my regular work. Put in a couple of hours, and the thing just grew and grew and grew until finally I had completed a full page. And then I took it down to the Sun about 6 weeks later after I'd completed it, and they accepted it and used it as the cover of a special edition on the 60s. This is a bit of a change of pace for me. It was done for the federal government's environment train many years ago when they sent a train across Canada that showed exhibits of ways to improve the environment. And to entertain the crowds before they got on the train, because there were lineups, they had a couple of cartoonists do cartoons that showed sort of stupid ideas as to how you might want to change the environment. I don't know if we can get in closer on this. We'll try. And this is called a slick licker, and it's supposed to clean up oil slicks. I don't know. It was never tried, although the government... The government did spend a lot of money on other rather silly inventions. This is a selection of books and book covers that I've done. As Pat mentioned earlier, there's the Canada ABC up in the corner, and some of the Frog Fables and Beaver Tales series, which was, I don't know, one, two, three, four, five books that we did with Stanley Burke. and had a lot of fun with that, and they were well received actually at the time, along with a book for Eric Nickel. I've done a couple with him, and then my own books more in the center there, Drawn and Quartered and The World According To, and a little book there, Raymond's Rain Dance, with which I did with one of the members of the Vancouver Sun who retired, and it was just a little book, and it only had a publication of about 500 copies, but we had a lot of fun just fooling around with it. Now, these are books that I've done with Ellen Fotheringham, and I've worked with Ellen since 1962, I guess. We started on page 6 of the Vancouver Sun. Ellen had worked at the Sun as a sports reporter and in other areas before that. But when I started at the Sun as a freelance, and I must point out that I am a freelance cartoonist. I've worked for 41 years at the Vancouver Sun, but always on one-year contracts. Had I known at the time, I would have worked a better deal. But as it turns out, I met Ellen, and we started to do things together on page 6. He was the page 6 editor for a couple of years, and that's when I learned his mindset, which helped me very much when he moved to Maclean's magazine. And it was on in Maclean's magazine that I became the illustrator for his back page column. And as a result, we worked for 23 years doing the back page and never missed a deadline in 23 years. And in fact, It was a bit of a franchise operation as far as we were concerned, because it was just the two of us. Alan would travel the world, and he would give me a phone call every Thursday or Friday and give me some sort of inkling on the column that he would write. Sometimes he had the column actually written, but most times he had half the column written, or he had a phrase or two that he was going to work with, and he would pass that on to me, and I would try and make a drawing and send it into Maclean's magazine. Now, he would phone me from Israel or Australia or Portugal, wherever. I was usually in Vancouver, but on the other hand, there were times when I was in Ohio or Florida or Iceland or Ireland or Portugal myself, and I would still do the drawing, and we would Federal Express it, or towards the end, we were using computers. But it was a wonderful 23 years, and it was something that has not been done in Canadian journalism. The last ones to do it was Jimmy Fries and Gregory Clark, and they really only worked together for about a year and a half, 2 years. So that's one of the things that I'm rather proud of. As you can see, it's all sorts of things there. The one in the towards the center shows a lot of Elvis Presley's, and that's the way the Americans celebrate July the 4th. And on the right is the way Canadians celebrate July the 1st. It shows the difference in the two countries. And now we get to British Columbia. This is BC Politics Explained. There's Election Day, when everybody should be making their statement, and then there's the rest of the time. And as you know, that goes on all the time. And then, of course, This was done in 1999 when Glenn Clark eventually washed up. And that, of course, eventually led to Thelma and Louise, who were the only two NDPers left in the legislature. And So they're saying, so Joy, what they say is true. The NDP really is like a Porsche Roadster. They both have two seats. Deal with it, Jenny. And then, of course, we have Gordon Campbell.
It just doesn't get any better, does it?
And this one I like for the drawing, really. It's Freud and Bourassa of Quebec. It was done in 1990. I just like the drawing. I don't know if you can read it. It says, Quebec is not understood by the rest of Canada. Have you ever considered that they understand Quebec too well? Now then, this is Mulroney when the economy was starting to slip in 1991. And prosperity was just around the corner. Two blocks down, hang a left. One block over, near the UIC office, just beyond the food bank, okay? I guess I don't have to say anything about that one. Some of these just explain themselves. Then, of course, Chrétien came into power. And if you look up in the right-hand corner, there's a backbencher that is being eased back into line. This was done in 1995. It was Chrétien's way or the highway. This one is the right-wing brothers. And they could never seem to get it together. And I thought, if they ever did get it together, it would be two right wings. So the Reform and Progressive Conservative have never really got it together. And they're still trying to get it off the ground, for that matter. Now then, this is Austin Powers, done in 1999. For me, it had the thrill of putting my job on the line and drawing my publisher in a cartoon, which is a very dangerous thing for a cartoonist to do. It was Conrad Black. A lot of people thought that Conrad Black came around to my house each morning for breakfast and told me what to draw. But this was really not the case. I've never met the man. And I have done three or four cartoons on him, as a matter of fact, when he was my publisher. And nothing was ever said. And this, of course, was when Chrétien was denying him his lordship in England. And he eventually left the country. Then, of course, Air Canada. We have Robert Milton playing Air Canada Solitaire. How you can keep losing when you're a monopoly is something only Canadians seem to be able to do. But of course, the airline industry everywhere is having a bad time, I guess. This one was done in the year 2000 when the IRA were really getting tiresome. They were really, you know, fighting every peace venue that they could. And this rather summed up the situation as far as I was concerned. Then, of course, we have the Rolling Stones. And we have Sir Nick, made a knight. And I look upon this as the death of rock and roll, really. Because when you're an anti-establishmentarianism, It just can't be. And it's one thing to get old, but it's something else to give up. And here, of course, we have Sharon and Arafat locked in the perpetual confinement, along with the Dove of Peace in its own cage. And it just goes on and on. And this one was called The Un-American Activities. And I always found it strange that it was un-American to trade with Cuba, and yet the United States were having this huge trade agreement with mainland China. I mean, who is the bigger communist? Who is the bigger scary guy? But, of course, if it's Canadians trading, then it's something else. So I think that rather sums up that situation. Now, this was done in January 1998. This was at the very start of the Monica Lewinsky affair, when it was just starting to come out. And so I jumped on it, naturally. And I received a letter from a Vancouver Sun reader who was vacationing in Hawaii at the time. And she was just livid that I would draw the President of the United States naked and in such a terrible cartoon. She just ripped me up and down for it. And I knew by her reaction that this cartoon was going to be a winner. And it won. And so it won the National Newspaper Award for that year, 1998. Now here we have Abraham Lincoln and Clinton. And Abe, of course, is saying you can't fool all the people all the time. But sort of like Groucho Marx there behind saying, but you can fool around and still maintain a 65% approval rating in the polls. And here's George Bush, the younger, W, saying, your daddy used to work for my daddy. And he's talking to the God of War here, who's in charge of the Cold War at the time. This was before everything was heating up. And Mars, of course, is saying, actually, it was the other way around. And then W finally got somebody to support his cause.
And it was a bobblehead from Britain, Tony Blair.
This was done in September 2002. And we come a little bit closer now, January 28th, 2003. And this is a takeoff on the Doctor Strangelove film. And Bush is playing the role of Chill Wills. And finally, we have Hitler and Osama. This was done in 2001. And Hitler is saying, not thee, mad monster of the new millennium. And this was chosen to be on the cover of this year's portfolio book, which is a collection of editorial cartoonists' work from across Canada. I've got a few cartoons in it, and you can see. But I'd like to round off the evening with a short video that was made for the Jack Webster Awards by Fred Causey. In it, I'd like to make a point that I've had a damaged eye as a result of a car accident many years ago. And when the film was made, the video was made, I hadn't had an operation yet to correct it. In the film, I tend to look like Popeye or somebody that's very, very sleepy. But anyways, let's take a look at it, if we can. And this is my assistant, by the way, Jeff, my son, who is my technical assistant.
Mm-hmm. my job as an editorial cartoonist is to attack power. That it's as simple as that, really. I attack power, and politicians have the power. They assume the power, they take the power, and they live the power for their career.
This is Paul Martin working on his next budget and sorting out where the money would go and who was going to pay for it.
If you want to chuckle every day, look on the comic page. That's why newspapers have comic strips.
This is Premier Glenn towards the end of his reign in office. We're taking you off virtual reality and putting you on pie in the sky.
Sometimes you just find something so ludicrous that you just have to point it out. I mean, we live in BC, and politics here, this is a frontier area, really. I mean, it's hard right or hard left, and the ideas just fall out of the trees. I mean, every morning, every day, something has happened here. You just have to pick up the fallen wing nuts.
I found that British Columbia is the only government of any province or state in North America that actually keeps its politicians on an island. And we do vote them off every so often. This was W.A.C. Bennett back in 1972 when one of his members defected to the Conservative Party. That was in January, and this was in April 27th, when a second member defected.
In Canada, I mean, we've had some really great politicians. We've had, Trudeau and Chrétien and Mulroney with a chin and Joe Clark without a chin. They're all so caricaturable that's great fun.
And this is a National Newspaper Award winner from 1994, and it's Federal Gump saying Quebec elections are like a box of chocolates. They're mostly smooth and mellow once you separate the nut clusters.
Chrétien has got a face that was made for cartoonists, editorial cartoonists. He was described, I think, by Camp as the driver of the getaway car. He's got this Belmondo-shaped face, which is beautiful. I mean, a lot of people go on about, oh, you shouldn't be distorting his face. Well, his face is like that. This is a caricature. Get used to it. Deal with it. I mean, I'm not that far out, left field or right field, quite frankly. I'm in the radical middle. And that's where most people are, I think, really.
And this is Paul Martin. This is how he got that wonderful surplus of money that we're all going to spend in the next few days. He got it by heavy taxation, and that caused tax rage. And really, if you're a politician, why not tax rage? This is Walter Tucker and Michael Baldessaro, who are seeking a federal contract to supply Health Canada with medical marijuana. And I don't know if the cartoon would ever be about marijuana or not, but it's just the look on their faces. These are happy people.
The ideas are always there. As an editorial cartoonist, all my work is based on what happens in the news. And so you have to be conversant with pretty well most of the details. You have to follow whatever is going on in Canadian politics, American politics, international politics, local politics.
This cartoon appeared right at the start of the Monica Lewinsky business, and it was about the second or third day that the various revelations were starting to come out. The cartoon actually won the 1998 National Newspaper Awards.
Trudeau was around for 14 years, I guess.
He always seemed to have a mask on for some reason, Trudeau, and so I used to use that theme quite a bit, actually. So right from the end of 1967 on, for 14 years, I always felt that it was happening around him and he was causing a lot of Trudeau mania, and yet he wasn't revealing himself completely to the people. And maybe that's why they loved him.
We've been together for over 20 years. It's about 22 years now. And he is a verbal cartoonist, essentially. The best illustration is one that triggers something in the reader's imagination and intrigues them enough to pull them into the column. That's your main job. The space between my pen or pencil on the paper and what the reader picks up, that's magic. That's where it either works or you lay an egg. It's that wonderful 7 seconds. It usually takes about 7 seconds to read a cartoon. It might take you more than a day in some cases. Usually it takes at least an 8-hour day to produce a cartoon, but you can read it in 7 seconds. I try to go for another 3 or 4 seconds. If I can get somebody involved in the first 7, they might want to look around and find something there for a few more seconds. It takes a lifetime. I've been drawing all my life, and to produce a cartoon, it's your entire life. It's not the number of hours that you've actually spent drawing it. It's everything else that you bring to the page. Once you've got the idea, once you've processed all the details, and once you've shaved them down to the minute particles, to the simple cartoon, then you have to start to draw it. And a lot of things can go wrong on the page when you're drawing it. And this is how I feel some days when I wake up and I have to work out a cartoon. It's sort of like I have the weight of the world on my shoulders. Each cartoon that I start, I'm hoping it's the best cartoon that I've ever done. I am honored by this award. I think this is incredible. I really did not expect it. And the fact that it's Bruce Hutcheson and Jack Webster, I mean, these are the tops in British Columbia and in Canada. These are giants. And to be given this honor under their name is just fabulous. And actually, as you may or may not know, he's a failed editorial cartoonist. And that's what happens to failed editorial cartoonists that become one of the great journalists, or the great journalist in Canadian history. I'm going to be drawing, even if I'm under the Burke's clock, with doing sidewalk drawings in chalk. I'll keep going.
Why?
I have nothing else to do. I don't have a pension. I'm a freelance cartoonist. That's the story of my life.
Well, that's it. Thank you very much. Okay, if you want to...
I'll tell them the book. Roy has agreed to take questions, comments from the floor. So it's open for your discussion.
Bad cartoons? Yeah. Oh, mad cartoons. Oh, poor. Oh, actually, I was going to include a photograph under my desk where you'll see all the bad cartoons. I have a stack of card, really, where I have failed attempts, cartoons that really didn't work, didn't come off. I was either not feeling well that day or was off my feet. I don't know. Sometimes they don't work at all. And on the other hand, I have done cartoons where I've made about 7 or 8 attempts to get what I want on the paper and finally got something out of it.
not one of the great cartoons, perhaps, but still I struggled and brought something out.
Way up there at the back.
Which politician gave you the most trouble as a
character? Which politician gave me the most trouble as far as drawing the caricature, I mean? It was Bennett the Younger, I think, really. He had a fairly even face. Pearson was not all that great either. He had a fairly bland face. It's when the characters have a large mustache or big ears or something like that that you can pin on. That's when it becomes easy. I mean, Chrétien, that's a wing nut falling out of a tree. You know, you just stick your hand out. But it usually takes about 6 months for me to start to feel easy with a new politician who comes on the scene when I'm drawing them. And it also takes the audience, I think, an equal amount of time at least to get the idea that this is who I'm trying to draw. Bob Bierman I don't know when that was. It was, I don't know, 15 years ago. That was the great lawsuit when he drew a cartoon of William Van Der Zaam, who was the human resources, minister at the time, pulling wings off a fly. And actually, Willie won that one. The first one, but it went to the BC Supreme Court, and the cartoonists won. And if you read the judgment that was brought down, you'll find that cartoonists have an even wider purview than they thought they had. And we have much more freedom, really, than any cartoonist is actually challenged. The only other cartoon that was challenged in the British Commonwealth was in New Zealand, I think, and that was at the turn of the century.
The Christian right here.
Mr. Peterson, your draftsmanship is so superior to what I see from other cartoons that I'm sure you must have tried a more serious art at one time or another.
I always... Yes. Have I ever done any serious art? as idiotic as that looks, that is my idea of serious art. But I have done one or two paintings, and I've always wanted to, and I would really like to get down to it, and I'd like to sculpt, too. But I just have not had the time. I'm always cartooning. There's always some job coming along that is taking up my time. So maybe in my next lifetime.
There's a question over there.
Mr. Peterson, you mentioned Len Norris, whose style reminds many people of Giles. And I know there's an American cartoonist who's won Pulitzer Prizes doing homages to Duncan McPherson.
Right. No.
And I'm wondering if I might ask what your own personal influence is.
Well, no cartoonist springs full-blown from his own brow. There's always influences. When I was a kid, I was looking at Sad Sack in the newspaper, which was a cartoon that appeared during World War II. Then I was looking at the Spirit comics, comic books, and... then I was looking at Mad magazine. This is early Mad. This is the Harvey Kurtzman Mad magazine with all the great artists that appeared there. And then as I grew older, I started to look at the work of Ronald Searle and some of the other great cartoonists from England and Daumier, that sort of thing. And I was influenced by them all in some way, I'm sure. Duncan McPherson was a great influence on me. Actually, he offered me three jobs at the Toronto Star over the years, and I decided to stay in Vancouver because it was a nicer environment, because Len Norris was doing social comment and I was doing the harder edge stuff. Len always said that my approach was the way I was going after the politicians who made the laws, and he was going after Mr. and Mrs. Front Porch who had to live with the laws. So it was we had a nice sort of relationship going there. And actually, when I started at the Sun, there was no way I was going to go into Len Norris's area because he was the master of that. I went the opposite way purposely. I enjoy both, actually. Black and white is great fun because I'm really used to it. Color, I really enjoy. I really like to get into molding the faces and bringing out a sort of a third dimension, if I can, in the cartoons. It takes a lot of time, though, color. And newspapers and magazines aren't really prepared to pay the amount of money that they would have to get that sort of thing. Nowadays, with computers, it's a lot easier. But if you look at computer-style cartoons, the color's fairly flat, and it's very quick. It can be done quickly, but it's not my style of cartooning, really.
Up in the middle up there?
Well, the answer to that is that you live in the real world and I live in a fantasy world. No, and these are all characters in my head rather than real characters. And I do tend to put words in their mouths that they don't necessarily speak, but you know that they are thinking about it anyways.
To the corner there?
In the early days, I did. Actually, when I started at the Vancouver Sun, Len Norris did all his life. He took in three ideas. He would spend a couple of hours each morning working on ideas. And the rule was that you would produce three ideas, and the editor would choose one. The editor always said that he could print any one of the three. But and I did that for a number of years, until I finally thought, well, this is rather ridiculous. You know, I'm losing two good ideas for each one that gets printed. And so we worked out a deal that I would just do the drawing and send it in. If they didn't like it, they could kill it. And that's only happened once or twice. The cartoons weren't actually killed. They were delayed for a day while lawyers pored over them. And then saner heads prevailed, and the cartoon appeared.
Woman up top there.
Have you ever had a deadline where you drew a blank because there was no news?
Now, you see, you've said that. And tomorrow or the next day, I'm going to draw a blank. People ask this question a lot, and I usually, a day or so later, I freeze. And I have no idea. But I've been doing it for 41 years, and I can crank out something and make some sort of comment of some sort. And it hasn't really been a problem.
In the green dress?
Yes, as soon as you don't have a pension, what do you do with all your drawings? Do you sell any of them, or do you archive?
Well, they're... they're actually archived between the National Archives in Ottawa. Simon Fraser University has started a collection of the BC cartoons. And Ohio State University in the United States archives the American and international cartoons that I do.
Thank you.
And I get a tax write-off on that.
Peter?
Would you care to describe the two cartoons of the lawyers poring over for a day?
Oh. Oh, well, one that I can remember was when I did a drawing of Van der Zandt, and it was a takeoff on the movie Darkman that had appeared, and I, of course, called him Dorkman. And at the time, that was considered rather risque. It's not anymore, but it was at the time. But it was a damn good drawing. And changes in style? It's evolved. It's still the same basic style. I like a lot of detail, and I don't do detail really so much in the background as Len Norris did. I like to get it in the face and in the character itself, and sometimes I like to put in little nuances that you have to look twice. If you're looking for 7 seconds, you might not see it. But if you hang around for another couple of seconds, you might pick up something that you hadn't noticed. I do that as much as I can. But the style for most cartoonists do evolve. And just as if you take a look at some of Len Norris's early work from, I don't know, the 1955 or so, and then compare it to what he was doing in 1979, 1980, you would see that he had been doing it so long that he had mastered it, and the brilliance was getting more and more brighter. And that's usually what happens. You refine your style.
One over here. Yeah.
You ever do human models? I'm thinking of the one of Mr. Clinton.
Oh. No, that... well, I went to art school for 8 years, taking night school courses, rather stupidly. I should have gone to art school for 4 years, got a diploma, and gone on with my life. Instead, I was working during the day at Woodward's and Eaton's advertising and display department and raising a family. And so I was going to night school 4 nights a week for 8 years, taking life drawing, theater set design, whatever courses I could get, I was studying it, and that went on for 8 years. And it was a damn good grounding that I might not have got in day school, but it was a rather long time. It's really in the faces. I love drawing faces. Yeah, I usually start around the eyes. It just sort of right in the center there. And once I've achieved that, if I can catch the look in the eyes and the nose, everything else seems to more or less grow from that area.
When someone feels that he's been properly secured, how do they try to get back at you, or do they ever try to get back at
you? You better repeat the question.
Well, how do my victims get back at me is how I could boil that down. It actually hasn't happened. A lot of politicians will ask for the cartoon, and I always make a point of selling the cartoon to them. And sometimes, if the price is too high, I'll send them just a copy of it for a lower price. But a lot of politicians are very vain, and they want the cartoon, whether it skewers them or not. And Smallwood in Newfoundland was a great one. He loved cartoonists, and he didn't mind if they attacked him or not, just so long as they drew him in the paper, because that kept his face in the public eye. He loved that sort of thing.
Do I detect in your cartoon, which included Conrad Black, your employer,
On that one, it was a bit kinder. I've done worse, actually. In Maclean's magazine and one or two of the Vancouver Sun cartoons, I was tougher on them. That was when I was just sort of feeling my way to see if there was any reaction coming. You sort of walk through the minefield first, and then you find the path, and then you start to explore around a bit more.
Up in the next row.
Mr. Peterson, aside from the monetary side, what reward or satisfaction do you get? I mean, you've been at it for such a long time.
Just really to be able to be a cartoonist, as I say, it's a one in a million job. And I've met cartoonists or would-be cartoonists who want to be editorial cartoonists and have tried most of their life to get into print, and some who have and have floundered after a year or so. It's a very hard medium to stay in and to keep going, because a lot of cartoonists burn out. And so that's part of the thrill, is to keep going every day and see if you can keep cracking the nut. And hopefully so far I've done that.
We'll take two more questions. One there.
Just you've been talking about Norris and Aislinn and Wicks and so forth, who are, may I say, the grand old men. And who are you now passing the torch to?
I'll bite. There's a couple of new young cartoonists. The cartoonist on the Ottawa Citizen, Cam, who is very good. There's Sebastian in Montreal, who's doing cartoons in a totally different vein, and they're more in the French tradition, although he's not really French-Canadian. He's very interesting. And, of course, Gable. Brian Gable in the Globe and Mail is a wonderful cartoonist, master of his oeuvre. Other than that, there are a number of other cartoonists, but those three sort of stand out, I think.
Over there.
Some of the ideas that you showed were so powerful because they required no words at all. I'm wondering, when you're at the execution phase, with the idea, are you consciously trying first?
Yeah, I find that if I can do it visually, it's more powerful. It has a greater impact. Then there are times when I start to get into my literary mode and start to work out conversations between characters, and then I get a bit too heavy with the words, and the cartoon is more or less interesting, but it's not as powerful if there are no words, or just one or two or three or four. And that's really goes back to symbolism in cartooning. If you can come up with a good symbol that states the case, that makes for the best cartoon, usually, at least in my case.
Well, this has really been fantastic, and not at all surprising to one who has watched you for all of these many, many years. And that would include Jack Lee, who is going to say the thank you for tonight. Jack?
Well, gee whiz, welcome to Kitsilano High School. ladies and gentlemen, and I want to thank President Pat, or Dean Pat, and Roy, and I think being just a little parochial, they probably are Kitsilano High School's two best known and most successful graduates in their respective fields, and I think you'd all agree. But I'm here to say thank you to Roy, and it is entirely my pleasure to do so. But really, this is a thank you to six people. First of all, there is Roy, as we've said, but there are some people here tonight. Sons Lori and Jeff, daughters Jillian, Lisa, and Karen, although Jillian could not be with us. She's over on the island with her career as a painter, but sends her best wishes. But the immediate family is here with Roy and they saw Roy's requirements, looked after his home life, and looked after his home needs, and ensured that he had the time to do what he's doing here tonight, and that is making the presentation to you. And I'd like to say that it was Jeff who, as I think Roy mentioned, put together the audio visuals. And so that is five people, and of course the sixth and is someone we wish to thank, and we all know is here with us tonight in spirit, and that is Margaret, who was Roy's wife, 45 years, his life partner, passed away 4 weeks ago tonight. They met at Woodward's, of course, and Margaret, a Scottish lass from Dundee, came to buy a can of paint on $1.49 day to redecorate her Kitsilano apartment, and left with another in-store bargain, an artist, itinerant artist from the display ad department named Roy Peterson. So, Margaret Peterson, she gave Roy the creative space he needed to develop the outstanding which you've seen here tonight. And Roy referred to his work always as our cartoons. And that creative space, ladies and gentlemen, was important, as we've seen, because Roy, and we have discussed this just the other night, we were discussing outstanding editorial cartooning. It isn't just about drawing, and any more than good writing is just about typing words. In both cases, as again you've seen tonight, it's all about our thoughts, the gifts that lead to be able to do cartoons or written pieces that transcend the obvious, works that evoke guffaws or tears or make the veins pulse in your forehead, and above all, they make you think. I wish I had known that we had this with us tonight, the AV capability, but you know, Roy gave us an example of what I've just said just recently, and I'm sure most of you will remember. He drew an eight ball, and behind it, peeking out, Saddam Hussein. Well, yes, I thought, it's pretty indicative of Saddam's position, until I read the caption. Aha, Saddam is saying, they're still behind the eight ball. What a reverse twist, and it just made your head go back. And that's that 7 seconds, Roy, you were thinking about, and it's also the months you said that we will remember. Now, sometimes Roy does stay with the obvious, and we also have the Space Shuttle Columbia, that terrible disaster. Roy Peterson, a frayed American flag on the left side of the drawing, with that well-known re-entry contrail of the stricken shuttle, extending out from one of the white stripes of the flag, and the simple caption, "On to a greater calling." How powerful was that? And it is something that you can only weep when you think about the skill and the feeling and the pathos. And I mention those two cartoons, ladies and gentlemen, because each being very different and yet very powerful. But I'd like you to know, and I think you must, that Roy created them shortly after the loss of his Margaret. And to me, and I'm sure to many of you, they defined grace under pressure during a most difficult period of his life. You know, editorial cartoonists face greater challenges than writers because they have to capture you at a glance, as I've just said. For instance, in 1994, we held a reunion of everyone who had ever served in the editorial departments of the Sun and the Province in the 1950s. I served as editor of a souvenir publication filled with nostalgia stories by writers such as Pierre Burton, Alan Fotheringham, Denny Boyd, Jim Kearney, many others. Great stories, all with creative leads, paragraphs that grabbed you, followed by some 20 inches of copy in which they brought to life those bygone days. Well, I asked Roy to do the cover, and he captured those days in a flash. The flash, of course, of an old speed graphic camera from the 1950s. And I'm going to put this up, and goodness hopes that it will come up on screen. No? I was misled. Sorry. I will then describe it for you, and please bear with me. But it's a cover of a news scrum of the 1950s. And here we have the speed graphic cameraman, the gal reporter trying to make it in the newspaper business, her pencils piercing his eye. You've got the reporter there with the phone to his ear. We're ready to phone the rewrite desk. And you've got the agate-eyed guy in the green eye shade, the news editor, with a copy spike where you put your dupes. And down here in the corner, the Roy Peterson detail, the book of matches from the Lotus Hotel, the local watering hole. The Peterson person that I'm talking about has done many other specialty covers over the years, and I'd like to just bear you to bear with me because he has done many for our Kitsilano High School grad class of 1954. And again, I'm sorry I can't use the AV, but this is one that he drew for us for our 1994 reunion. And there's the young guy in his obligatory Kits jacket with the gold and blue colors. He's wearing the strides or drapes of the 1950s with the two-button high and about the 34-inch knee and the 14-inch cuff. The girl is wearing the obligatory Angora sweater, the skirt with crinolines, and, of course, the bobby socks and the bobby sock shoes. So saddle shoes. Thank you very much. So those are labors of love for our Roy, and it is something that we cherish because to have Roy Peterson do a cartoon that we give away the original by lucky number draw is something very, very special. In conclusion, I'd like to go over something that has been said here tonight. We were discussing the state of newspaper editorial cartooning just recently. Roy noted to me the importance of the genre seems to be diminishing. Although he named some up-and-coming young men here tonight, when his peers in 1983 elected him president of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, which at that time encompassed both the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, the membership was around 400. And today, the total membership is about 83. Luckily for us, the son has told Roy he will be with them for as long as he wishes to be, probably, as he said, because he doesn't have a contract and he's on a series of one-year contracts. Nevertheless, I'm sure you've all noticed and that we've all talked about that status, and the son, of course, has acknowledged that themselves just recently by putting his name on a masthead with Roy Peterson's viewpoint about damn time. Roy, with your family members giving you such solid support, with Margaret residing with you, within your heart, always in your thoughts, all of us look forward to applauding your formidable creative efforts for many more years to come. Meantime, we sincerely thank you and your family for sharing your life with us here tonight. Thank you.